Welcome, everyone, to episode number 96 of Underserved. With me in studio today is Chris Boudiette, Manager of Software Engineering at Shell TechWorks. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Chris, thank you so much for coming down to join us on Underserved.
Thanks for having me. I love your stuff.
So way back when, gaming was your first love?
Yeah. Gaming really got me into software initially. Quake 2, you know, you name it, whatever the game is, loading through DOS, I tell you, that really got me excited about software.
And you like checking out all the demos and trading stuff? And
Oh, yeah. My dad, his friend, used to get PC gaming magazines, and then he'd bring in the CDs over to me, and I'd get to load them up and play them, and that really got me excited about gaming.
Designing your own levels and the whole nine?
Yeah, so I got connected to some of my dad's, like, his friends and their kids, and one of them, I remember back in the day, like, really got into level editing, and he got me into it, and, you know, it was really cool to see, you know, an idea turn it into something that was actually, like, in the virtual world. It was pretty awesome.
That's cool. Did you have any computer science in high school?
Yeah, good question. So my high school didn't actually have computer science curriculum. So me and a couple of kids like really wanted to get into it. So we pushed for a remote class per se. And I got to take that and didn't have the outcome I wanted. The first time was like the first remote class I ever took, but it got me enough excited about it that I got the bug and went to college for that.
So where do you end up going to school?
I went over to UMass Lowell.
Okay. And what did you study? Did you go in there for CS or?
Yeah, so I went directly for CS. I did the 5-year program. I took like three essentially like kind of capstone type projects there. One was like database, one was graphic, one was user interface that extended it. I could have got a minor in art if I took art history, I think, and maybe one other class, but that was just to practice the other part of my brain too while I was there.
I think that's a good idea. I'm also a big fan of the 5-year plan. I did it at UMass Amherst. Did you have any instructors or courses that you found particularly great while you were there?
So there was a lot of great instructors. I remember Jim Canning was one of my favorites in the early days. He was someone that really pushed you to work hard and really wanted to make the best. And he was also one of the people that was the hardest because he'd be weeding people out of the program, you know, as it was going on. He was a great teacher and professor. And then also I really enjoyed both user interface design and also graphic design. Graphic was because it was more in like the 3D space, and user interface was more of like a building web apps and things at the time. It was pretty cool.
Now, on the art side of the curriculum, you got really into ceramics?
Yeah. You know, I don't know what got me directly into ceramics. I think like just growing up, I did a lot of like my own clay modeling and stuff myself. And it was another opportunity to turn things into like 3D space. And I was a little different than a lot of the art students. I did more of like characters and like that you'd imagine from like animated, like stop motion animation type stuff and everything. I did a couple like really artsy things. And one of them is like a picture of it online. It's pretty cool. It's like a few night earn. It's like a little on the deeper side.
So wait, you did stop motion animation with like clay and stuff, or?
That was back in like high school. And that's what got me into it. And so like I still built some of the similar characters in the ceramics class.
Now, while you were in school, you were also working at Computer Surplus Solutions?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
What were you doing there?
So like three of us basically ran the shop. We got the spillover from like what the Geek Squad couldn't fix.
Which is everything.
Yeah, which is everything. And then like people who get like frustrated with Comcast or Verizon. And then also like people that couldn't afford these like high expensive computers would actually build them based on like buyout, you know, whatever companies had as leftover inventory, and then build them all up so we could sell them pretty cheaply so people could afford them too. So there I really did a little bit of everything. It was building PCs, fixing PCs, it was doing the marketing, helping out with the site, taking all the calls, running the QuickBooks and stuff like that, you know, when I needed to, opening the shop, running it myself. It was kind of nuts.
What was it like getting exposure to the business side, like having to run things when the owner wasn't there?
It was great. I tell you, even before that, I was running my own lawn mowing business as like from like 14 on. You know what I mean? So like it really wasn't anything too crazy. It was kind of natural. You know, it wasn't too bad.
And so you're building these affordable machines and going on service calls. Like what other type of stuff are you doing for your customers?
Oh, man. So backing up their data, you know, data recovery, that was like another big thing at the time. We had like machines that we had like not even in a PC box. It was actually like strapped along the wall. So it looked like we were running like a data center there, at, you know, at some point. But, you know, data backup, cleaning out viruses and setting up networks and all that fun stuff.
Oh, so you're having to like tear apart the guts of a hard drive and try and get someone's term paper back for them?
Yeah.
Okay.
We didn't have a clean room, so we never got that crazy, but yeah.
So what do you do after you graduate ULOL?
So after I graduate ULOL, I jumped into a company called Symbotic. That was an automated warehousing company, similar to Kiva, but Kiva is more on like the each pick where they focus on the individual products. We were focused on like cases of products, everything from depalletization to storage, then to, you know, repalletization onto the trucks that take it to the grocery stores.
Is it primarily like grocery stuff in bulk or?
It started that way. It quickly like grew out of that. And I'm not sure what groups that are public right now, what they're working with. So, but yeah, grocery and expanded beyond.
Now, you had a story about your enthusiasm when you were first hired.
This is a story about don't be afraid to be different, right? They tell us like in the initial town hall, like we're going to introduce you, just say you're super happy to be here. And then tell us a little bit about yourself, right? And they're going one person after the other. Everyone's droning on like, you know, I'm this and I'm happy to be here, you know? And I was like, you know, I'm going to say something a little crazy. I said, my name is Chris. And I'm super stoked to be here. And it got to the point where the CEO actually had t-shirts made for everyone that's joined. They're like, I'm super stoked to be here, launching t-shirts out of cans and stuff. I didn't expect for it to be. I became like a
meme.
Yeah, a meme. You know, a meme in the office. Yeah.
You know what? If you're becoming the positive meme for the company, that's a good thing.
At least I hope. I mean, honestly, I was probably the butt of a lot of jokes too, but you know, it was fun.
I've always been a believer in standing out instead of blending in.
Yep.
So what kind of problem are you solving there? Like getting density of warehouses to be better or?
Yeah, good questions. It was a couple aspects. It was one, try to build out that full chain in equipment for depalletizing, come up with new algorithms to help make it more efficient. So like the speed was one. Also, the organization of product based on expiry dates and things like that was really important. And then the other piece was really like density, like you said, wanted to be able to build what we called like guerrilla warehouses. So really close to the source where they actually needed them. And that was like a whole challenge in itself, trying to make it as small as possible.
And so the robots, are they kind of like rolling around autonomously or do you have to train them? How do they know what to do?
So we would map out the entire warehouse in like, think of something like CAD, right? So map it out in like a CAD system and it would build out waypoints of, you know, where all the locations are. And then we'd build methods on the bots would help with like localizing where they are, you know, within that system, like checking in, you know, and where they pick up the pallets and knowing exactly what level they're on and everything else. And then to the point where they know which lane they're on. And it was basically building out the warehouse in nodes and then essentially making the bots be able to localize themselves. That was the other key piece.
What happens when they don't know where they are or something goes wrong?
Oh, yeah. Good question. So I can at least say this for line sensing. That was like one of the technologies to help identify where they were. Imagine a white painted line on a deck. And imagine if you have something like Bisquick or flour or something that's also white explode in the warehouse and cover all these lines up. That was fun getting all the bots out of there that day.
Are they like automated forklifts? They just like forked one of the big bags?
Essentially, yeah.
You know, I imagine this has to be some important time, like during a demo or something like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it never happens during the time where, you know, there's no demo. You don't have a CEO like standing over your shoulder, right? Of course. So, yeah, it was actually during a big demo. I remember that day.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Marist Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
Now, you were big into like safety and QA while you were there as well, right?
Yeah. So I'm a firm believer in like working from the ground up and really learning and growing and like earning that kind of next rank. And I figured like one of the best ways to kind of learn the system was to start, you know, within the quality assurance side. And I wasn't just a typical quality assurance, like just, okay, here's a bug, go fix it. I'd go in and look into the code, try to learn a little bit about it and then say like, oh, well, this code needs to be more testable by doing this, or this is where the actual bug is and here's how you'd fix it. That was really fun.
So you are that rare dream person that like comes from the CS background, but still digs doing some QA and like actually like
absolutely,
getting your hands dirty and going that extra mile and like, hey, here's how I'd fix it too.
Oh, yeah.
Was that always well received, or did the developers ever blanch at it?
No, actually, like, it helped me get the next opportunity, because, like, all the developers really loved it, because, like, otherwise they'd be chasing around the bug and trying to figure it out. So never really was met with any resistance, which was good. I mean, that was a good culture there.
You wrote a simulator to help out with the testing?
Yeah, so eventually getting to the point where we had to run like a team managing the safety certification of like a safety processor, and we had to decouple like between the hardware and the actual logic itself. So we built like simulators, and me personally, I built a simulator for like the communication protocols back and forth between the bot for the safety system. And that got crazy because I ended up showing it to the developers, and they're like, hey, is this basically work how, you know, the actual system would work? They're like, actually, we haven't fully built out the communication system. Could we use some of this code? So that was kind of funny. Maybe, maybe not. Some of my code's still living there. Who knows?
So stubbing out like little reactors and making like easy test drivers, I think that's a great habit. Being a tool builder, I think, is a great habit. That's like my question number two whenever I'm interviewing anyone.
Yep.
You know, tell me about a time that you built a tool, and like, did you make it part of the institution? Did you help other people use it? You know, did you train other people on it? I think that's a great habit. You talked a bit about the proactor and reactor patterns.
The safety processor had we had to build a message handler for it. And there are different ways to build out the message handler, and we're trying to make it as efficient as possible. And so it got me down the road of looking actually into the proactor and reactor pattern. I had a mentor that was like, hey, you know, check out these patterns. You know, you can do a lot with like a single thread actually, and built some of that out into the code as well. And it was also well received and kept down on the processing power, which was nice.
Now, you met some smart folks there, including one of the folks that pioneered the USB protocol.
Yeah. So Todd Commons, he was one of the folks that helped pioneer the USB protocols, and he was really a great mentor, and he helped to bridge the gap between the EE knowledge and then the software knowledge when we were doing that safety processor project.
And you said Angie Aykroyd was also a great PM there?
Yeah, she was excellent. Definitely want to be on her good side. Want to be on her good side.
That's every PM,
that's
right?
That's every PM, yeah. She was awesome. She really helped open up different opportunities to really get more scope and deliver more. And it was awesome.
So what made you want to move on from there?
There's like a couple of things. So first of all, I'm someone who's an avid learner. Like, I really like learning new things, and new challenges and diversity of thought helps me out there. And I was kind of getting a bit stagnant. You know, I was working on the safety processor for a while and everything. I still loved what I did. But at the time, Angie had moved on to another company. Todd did as well, that same company, which is now Shell TechWorks. And they were like, you know, I think this is something that you would like, Chris. And they gave me a call. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm looking right now type thing. And went to the interview, and one thing led to another. And, you know, here I am 8 years later.
But changing jobs wasn't the only big event that happened to you around this time.
Yeah, I went through a tough time with the family around where my mom passed suddenly. It was kind of unexpected, and helped me kind of reevaluate my life situation, where I was at, and really going after some different audacious goals. And one of my goals is always learning more about startups and how they work and operate, and the hopes one day running my own startup, you know what I mean? And this opportunity that I was talking about, the TechWorks one, kind of gave you the foundation with the financial support in order to kind of help do it. And I can explain a little bit of that later too, if you want.
Yeah, absolutely. So you land at TechWorks. What are you working on initially?
Yeah. So I started on like a couple different projects. So one of the first projects was like a research project with MIT. We were creating a system which required a bunch of different nodes that would read from, you know, using accelerometers as part of this person's research to help determine structural integrity. He actually got his dissertation on that. So that was that we helped to design and build the nodes, everything from hardware all the way to the point of actually building the software that ran, fed it back to like a main server system.
Now, Shell, giant worldwide company.
Yep.
A lot of companies like the idea of having like an incubation lab and being small and nimble and having these little cells within them that can, yep, you know, move faster than the giant company can. How did they implement that?
To answer that question, to go into a little bit of the history of TechWorks, right? So our founder at the time, Sean, he read the Skunkworks book. And if you're really interested, read chapter 16 of the Skunkworks book. And it kind of gives you a little bit about the inception of TechWorks. And that's where, you know, the works came out of, you know, out of TechWorks. But bottom line is, there was a recognized challenge within the industry where, you know, been in the same mode of operating for a while, you need to really shake things up and be open to shaking things up. The only way you can do that is bring people actually from the outside of the industry with fresh, different perspectives. The other thing was to actually give them the top cover to be able to operate freely. and truly innovate. And then also like keep them hungry, right? Like a startup. And that was where you have to get funding from the businesses themselves. It's not just something that we have a central fund to do it. We get new work through like word of mouth and doing good work and everything. So
it almost sounds like it was like a startup or gig based, like you pitch an idea.
Exactly.
And then if it catches on, like who are the different roles within that little cell?
So we've evolved over the years, like a whole bunch of different ways, but like where it is currently, so we have an internal BD group, and then we have our two delivery engines, right? So that's the system side and then the product side. So the way that we look at it is the system side helps to like frame up the problem, you know, that's being solved. Map out the solution space, identify where the gaps are, do the market scans, you know, really make sure that what you're going to build is something that's needed by the business, and it'll be actually really valuable, right? And then if it's something that can't be bought or it's something that doesn't already exist, that's where we get into either integrate or build mode. And that's where the product side comes into play. And the product side, we have software, which is the team that I run. We have electrical, and then we have mechanical. So under one roof, we really cover like the full spectrum. You know, one of the key things for us is we're not experts in, you know, everything. We know that. And so we do is we know enough about the different areas to be able to also link up to the other groups and, you know, when needed to help deliver something.
Now, do the business groups actually like provide the champion, if you will, like the person that wants to see this succeed for a very specific reason, or is that person part of your group?
There's a couple different ways, right? So it depends if it's a push or a pull. If it's a pull, typically the business always have that champion. And for projects to be successful, what I've always seen is you need a champion, you need the experts that are with the champion, you need the stakeholder who's funding and tied into the strategy. And then you need the experts to actually deliver, you know, to deliver the meat of it, right? So the business does typically supply the champion. On pushes where we're trying to like seed a new idea, right? So we have like this launch program. Say we identified an area within the business that's pretty challenging and has like a potential for a high value project, right? And we know technologies that we could tie to that high value problem. We'll actually do like a little launch program, very short time frame. We call it short-term research and build out that seedling and then go out to find the champion. So we didn't start with the champion. We were the champions. And then we went out and find the champions to help deliver that or to embed it really in the business.
Syrinx has spent a lot of time and effort over the past 25 years building our reputation for quality and our brand. There was one big problem though. No one could pronounce our name correctly.
Person on the street, brand testing, take one. Hi, can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
That's a really good guess.
Really?
Now, how would you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
Not even close. Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx.
Luckily for us, Syrinx was acquired in 2022 by the DeWinter Group. We're rebranding Syrinx under DeWinter's highly regarded technology consulting arm, Maris Consulting Group. We bring Syrinx's deep technology delivery experience, and they bring broader delivery capabilities and a new identity as Maris.
Here's what you can count on from the unified Maris. We are now a nationwide powerhouse when it comes to technology consulting, from DevOps to developers, to project managers, to business systems.
So join me in welcoming our future as Maris. Hopefully people will have an easier time pronouncing this one.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maris.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maurice.
Is that your uncle's name? Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Mars.
That's a planet.
Maybe not.
So contact Maris today, and we'll help you get your project done on time and on budget. You can call us at 408-297-7500, or you can find us on the web at mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com. And then what sort of things are you tackling? I imagine that Shell petroleum extraction is a big part of the business. What else?
You know, companies in the energy industry are so large and they cover such a broad set of challenges where, I'll be honest, most of my projects aren't even in the petroleum extraction space, like you said. They're actually in, you know, everything from new energies, trying out new businesses, trialing tech to help improve ways of working, safety, reducing the risks, you know, for the people that are working on site, and also strategic planning software to help with that modeling and everything. Not a lot of people think about the energy industries as like a really cutting edge industry because they think just that, like, oh, it's just pulling, you know, oil out of the ground or petroleum out of the ground. But the reality is there's so many different areas and aspects that like you could spend an entire lifetime and still not understand every aspect of the industry.
Yeah, and I think that even the big petroleum companies see, like, you know, there's being laws passed in the United States to have things lower emissions or be completely electrified by X year, and they want to skate to where the puck's going to be.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit like Shark Tank, where you're kind of going in and like pitching your idea to see whether or not they pick it up.
Yeah. So just like I was saying, like getting that startup experience, it really is like where you're pitching. You have to create your proposal, like what the value statement's going to be, what your roadmap's going to be. You get that hook, you know, just give them the why before giving them the what, you know, you're going to build. It's been incredible, you know, the amount of learnings we've kind of had from that. Some are easier to sell than others.
And depending on when, it might be easier to sell than others. I know when you arrived there, the industry had kind of taken a hit around 2016. What was that like?
I was just one of the QA people, you know, on the team at the time. I wasn't leading the group. You know, there was about 8 of us or so. The industry took a hit. We were then working mostly on doing system engineering, not as much software engineering. The software engineering market was really big at the time. So then you've got people like that have a lot of capability. They're kind of sitting around doing things they really don't love doing. And they started to kind of move away. And before you know it, like the team was down to like me and one other person. And that was scary. But at the same time, with anything scary, it kind of leads opportunities. For me, I took that as an opportunity to take leadership of the team. I saw some of the gaps that, you know, we had, why it was hard to get some of those software projects. And, you know, 8 years later, here we are, a team of 9, you know, delivered over $1 billion of value, spun out companies, did licensing gigs with external companies, and it's been a wild ride.
What have you noticed about being a leader versus being a hands-on engineer that you like or that you miss?
So obviously, you know, without a doubt, missing the ability to like work on something super challenging yourself, get that joy of the final delivery, you know, hey, I did this and this is what I specifically delivered. And man, I learned so much and, you know, get into like the details. And I'm a geek at heart. So, you know, I love all that stuff. And then on the management side, you got to really embrace the fact that your success is through others. For me, I've always been someone who likes to help kind of prop people up. And, you know, as a manager, that's one of your key objectives is you always want to bring people on and get them better than yourself and help them to grow in their career. And when they're excited and they're passionate, then they're able to give you their best self. And it really makes a great team. And it was a unique opportunity. I got to build the team from the ground up. So, you know, all of us are passionate and really love what we do. And seeing that and going through that, and then versus like the technical, you get way more ability to influence more outcomes than just the individual projects. So I really love that. But yeah, that's always been a tension. It's always been a tension.
How do you kind of instill or nurture that passion?
For me, being able to mentor, you know, others and learn about what they're doing and live vicariously for what they're working on, their technology, and have them talk about how passionate they are and how it works and everything. Side hobbies. I do write like little code, you know, on the side, widgets and stuff, you know, not as much as I used to, but still do that to stay passionate.
Lead by example and like have an infectious enthusiasm yourself.
Exactly.
So you mentioned hobbies and you know, you do some coding here and there, but what else do you do for fun?
Oh man. So I'm a hobby addict. I mean, I love everything from cooking and the joy you can bring to others through cooking, the meditation and working on motorcycles and building things, the ability like with carpentry to shake the perfectionist approach because you can't be a perfectionist in woodwork. Everything has a weird angle or something that you're always working around. Scuba diving, exploring like new areas and, you know, that I've never explored before. Kind of like feel like an astronaut like you on the cover of season 7, right? So yeah, man, it's just all of it. It's just learning. It's hard to find out what I haven't done or haven't tried. I don't know if it's a search for different passions or what, but for me, I just like learning.
So Arvind Singh, who was a previous underserved guest, the title of his episode was Addicted to Learning. I've seen a lot of technologists, yourself and myself included, that always want to be learning something, always want to be figuring out something new. And you get used to going through that awkward beginner phase. I don't know anything. I feel overwhelmed to like mastery.
And then back to knowing nothing.
Yeah.
Back to knowing nothing.
It's quite humbling.
Yeah.
Now you had a story specifically about a motorcycle you were restoring.
Yeah. So, you know, like anything with your career, there are different ways you can kind of help kind of get through it. And actually, you know, one of my good friends and mentor, Bob Colby, he worked at TechWorks. And when I said like there was two of us, like he was the other person, right? And, you know, we used to ride together and like then would talk about work and mentorship and everything after back at his farm. He ended up unfortunately getting lung cancer and passed, but you know, all of his teachings and everything kind of still live on. And one of the things is, you know, that love for motorcycles as well. And so I, you know, worked with his wife. His wife actually had one of his motorcycles in the barn and she's like, can you take this and do something with it? Right. And so it was an old BMW 2003 1200 CL. It's a very old, you know, one of the clunkers is one of the ones BMW over-engineered. You know, it has a cup holder, you know, on it and everything. But anyway, I took that thing, went through it with a fine-tooth comb, pulled every part, you know, everything apart, fixed and refurbished everything I could. And yeah, I'm looking to potentially sell it, hopefully donate a chunk of the money to charity. That's what the goal is. But yeah, that was a good meditation for me to kind of do something like that.
The restoring motorcycles, my dad was into that towards the end of his life. And we had talked about restoring like an old Indian from the 40s. And he talked me out of it. I'm glad he did, because it's a lot of work. What did you have to do on that BMW?
So the BMW, I'll be honest, didn't have to do too much. It was mostly like electrical work, tracking down the electrical gremlins on that. Once I did that, just the brake system has something called a buzzy brake system. Take off the gas tank, you look in, there's like 18 brake lines coming out of it. I don't even know how like the inner workings work. But yeah, so the brake system had some issues there, but mostly it was electrical. And the pannier, so like the box on the side, you'd think it would just be a, you know, a latch and that's all you need to kind of latch it up. It had like over 100 parts behind the latch to lock it, you know, in typical engineering. And this, I had to fix it, and I ended up just buying a whole new cover, which was like $500 at the time. That was crazy. It is crazy how expensive these parts are.
Someone in Bavaria went a little bit crazy designing that one.
Oh, yeah. 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 That's what happens when you let engineers use their imagination, right? They'll engineer as much as they can, right?
What are you making when you're woodworking?
Typically just stuff that I need, or like, you know, little things for different people, right? So like one of the things we needed, so when we first looked at our house where we live out of Salem, when we went in, it was staged with this giant mirror in the dining room, and it was a big mirror. And we're like, hey, can we get that mirror, you know, at the house? We'll throw some money, whatever. No, this is, I really like this mirror. So one of the first things I built was this massive, massive mirror. And the funny thing is, like, you think a mirror is simple. It's just you get a couple of miter joints around the side, you know, call it a day, right? Then you got to worry about the weight of it, the structure, you know, how does it hold together, getting the mirror itself actually into it without shattering it, which I did once.
So, oh, bad luck. 7 years.
Yeah. I mean, that's if you believe in it. now it's out in the universe. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
You're welcome.
But yeah, so like mirrors, build benches. I built my niece like a little jewelry box completely out of a log. I took a log and sliced it up into thin slices, ran through planer, joiner, got everything set up, finger joints, you know, just a bunch of little cool things.
And for scuba diving, where's the best spot you've been to so far?
Without a doubt, I've really loved the Cayman Islands. Funny story, my parents, they were on the honeymoon in the Cayman Islands, and my dad actually brought like one of those underwater cameras, which I actually still have, and he took all kinds of pictures, and it really got me excited about like that area. And when I went, it's like crystal clear water. The first time I went was on my tri-dive. The first day I was like swimming with a shark, and like we're chasing the shark around with cameras. And like after we got up, it's like, yeah, like you were very brave. You know, then I'm like, should I have worried? I'm like, I know they got teeth, but I was following you, man. And he goes, oh yeah, a few weeks back something happened, but don't worry about it.
What about motorcycling? Where do you like to go on the North Shore?
You know, where I live, we've got like the Essex Scenic Byway that you can kind of go up. So you go up through Beverly along the coast, you go up around Gloucester, like Bass Point, you go around, and then you get into Rockport, which is also good for diving. And then you go back around and you can get into Newburyport, Plum Island. You can just go all the way to Canada with just beautiful views the whole way.
And what would you say kind of makes you tick? Like, are there any themes like across your career that you've noticed popping up over and over?
Yeah. So aside from like learning new things, which is really big, I really enjoy the connections. And so like the connections around like singular challenges and just forming a group around delivering on whatever that challenge is and get everyone, you know, as excited as you are about solving it. So yeah, that really makes me tick.
And what about kind of being empathetic? Do you think that's important in a field that is largely non-empathetic?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't say it's largely non-empathetic, but I get your point there. Yeah, empathy is a huge thing for me. Like, it's also why I don't have a ton of social media, you know what I mean? Because just like feeling the best parts of everyone's day, you know, all the time can get you down, you know, you don't see the gaps right in between. But at any rate, so having like that high level empathy, most people don't try to understand both sides, you know, of any argument. And the reality is you got to be able to take the best of each argument and then help to bring out, okay, what's the right path forward based on the best of each argument. But you do got to hear each other out, and sometimes you can be dogmatic about it. So the empathy helps me not be dogmatic about it.
You have to pick your battles somewhat.
Of course, yeah.
You know, like even if you know you might have a better idea with something.
Politics exists.
Give a win on this one because you got a bigger battle to win somewhere else.
Exactly. Exactly.
What about the importance of staying humble?
So important. Let's be real. No one knows everything, right? You can always learn something from anybody. And actually, one of the funny things that really highlights it more from what I do than anything is, like, I feel like we learn more from our interns, all of our developers, than we do from, like, just reading books and stuff, because getting them the ability to express themselves and being creative, getting them passionate about something, and then, like, having like a philosophical debate about how something is developed and why, you know, they can come up with a fresh perspective. You're learning new things while doing it. And, you know, that's just one example, but I mean, there's plenty of others.
Yeah. I think mentoring, like sometimes you get in a mode and you're like, all right, I got to teach this kid to fish and it's going to be kind of annoying. And like, do I have time for this? You get into it and start doing it, and they do sometimes illuminate you to things you hadn't thought of, or looking at things a different way that it wouldn't have been in your perception, but a fresh set of eyes really kind of sets you off.
Absolutely. And then you can also build lifelong connections. I try to stay and connect with everybody, and you never know who you're going to bump into down the road too, right? So give them the best experience possible.
Well, not just interns. It seems like your network was kind of crucial from moving from job to job and role to role within them.
Yeah. You know, I gravitate towards people that are passionate about what they do. And I'm lucky enough to work with a lot of passionate people. And I've learned something from all of them. I'll tell you right now, like we talked about learning, being a manager, a first time kind of manager, like I tell you, there was a lot of learning steps, you know, to get to that point. And I'm completely humble and know even people on the team, like you did this, but there's a way here that you could do it might be better, and can't be like, hey, you know, shut down those ideas. You got to learn from yourself and figure out what you want to take forward.
I think we all imagine in our heads that when you get into any sort of leadership position, you need to have this iron exterior, and you can never say, I don't know.
Yep.
And you can never appear to not have a solution to a problem. And it can be kind of crippling and make you feel frozen.
Yeah, it's like that imposter syndrome thing. But the second you shake that away and help foster a culture where anyone can say anything, like that's where the best ideas are formed. Because reality is most of us are faking it till we make it. Let's be real.
But no one's admitting it to each other.
I'm admitting it right now. I have no idea what I'm doing. I still don't, you know.
I'm still faking it. So Chris, can you share with us how you think about product development and specifically how you're doing it now?
Yeah, there's been a whole bunch of learnings, you know, along the way, specifically like around how you actually commercialize something inside of a larger organization. If you're just building POCs, it'll stay on a shelf, right? If you're thinking about the end before you even, you know, start something, then you'll never build it. And so for us, we've kind of evolved to like this mindset of pioneering, right? So the pioneering phase, you're really just trying to prove a value and viability of whatever you're going to build. And that's where you're forming a team around the solution. And the key to success in that phase is really aligning people around the solution and making sure those incentives are aligned, because you can have folks, and I'm sure other people know in large organizations, that are more risk adverse because their role is to reduce risk, right? And so fostering that solution-driven mindset is super critical in that pioneering phase. It should be known that like in that phase, you can build something and then throw it out, you know what I mean? And just take the learnings from it and move forward. Or you could kill it at that phase, or it could seed to the next phase, which is like the settling phase. And that's when you're trying to do your like alpha and your beta testing, right? That's where you're really testing with the internal users. They now think it's great. And then you're getting to the beta phase, which is we really need to figure out a more diverse set of like different regions or different areas of the business that could take on, you know, whatever this tool is. And then you start thinking about your commercialization strategy. And that's where it's like, it could be spun out as a company. It could be something spun into, you know, the internal group, the internal IT organization. Maybe it's IP that could be licensed. And once you come up with those decisions, that helps drive the path forward, like that final phase, which is called like the town planning. Now it's the embedment. Like, how do you actually embed it in the business? And we've taken that whole process and broken it down into those phases. And there's different tools and techniques we use at each one to kind of help move it forward. And that's evolved out of a need, you know, that we've seen, because like as soon as we're not involved or the management thinks that, okay, you just build something, toss it over the fence, another group can immediately take it. We all know that's not the case. We really got to foster it and shepherd it through that whole pipeline.
Yeah, I think as engineers, our instinct is I want to perfectly design this thing, but quickly.
Yeah.
And then build it exactly right the first time and it be great and then not have to do all that legwork for kind of institutionalizing it.
Exactly. You can have fun in both parts, but yes, way more fun to be in the pioneering phase, 100%.
I think Agile has helped everyone wrap their head around like, okay, we're going to have to iterate. We'll build something. The first version will suck. It'll barely do anything, but then we'll kind of iterate on it and maybe we'll discover things that we didn't think of the first time around.
Exactly. You can't know where you want to be unless you at least try a few things. You know, and also know what won't work.
And I think building into the project plan and the budget that institutionalization has to happen and we need to evangelize this and get other people using it and excited about it and maybe even eat some of our own dog food.
Google pioneered that whole dog food saying, you know, like you gotta eat it yourself, you know, before you serve it. That is so true. And the evangelist piece, that can't be overlooked as well. If you're starting a company, you know, you got marketing, finance, and then, you know, the product, right? You're doing the similar things even if you're in a large organization, especially when it's like the size of a country.
Now, you recently got to go to South by Southwest. What was that like?
So it was my first time in Austin. Austin's nuts. It feels like they're taking like a bunch of like from the tech world. So like our team over at TechWorks, we built like a VR application. Just like we gamified, also made some educational VR for like wind energy and then hydrogen energy. And we got the opportunity to rent out essentially a bar. So like Anton's. And in that we got to set up a whole bunch of panels and, you know, also set up the VR system and have experts from all different areas and Shell there. And it was great to just meet a lot of different people and hear their thoughts, you know, on the energy transition and everything.
Were there any other companies or art displays or concerts or anything that you saw that you were like, oh, wow, I'm really glad I got to see this year?
We were working long days there, just to be honest. Like, it was hard to get out. But when I did get out, I remember Dolby had some cool stuff there. Slack had some really cool stuff. So they also rented out buildings. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of other cool ones. So we came in before most of the South by Southwest, like the movies and the music kind of came through. So didn't get to experience as much as I would have hoped, you know, reflect. But I mean, we still got to experience a lot.
Next time, book an extra week.
Next time, I'll book an extra week. Yeah, I should. I was kicking myself after.
Chris, thank you so much for coming down, joining us, and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew, today for putting up with me. I really appreciate it.
And we hope you enjoyed the Mighty Subs.
Oh, it's too big. So big.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.